Hello and welcome to Behind the Buyouts, the Deals podcast, where we speak to private equity and venture capital practitioners about their deals and deal making. I'm your guest host, Nikita Satyaraju, senior reporter at The Deal. We have with us today Matt Nassier, principal on the originations team at middle market firm Lincolnshire Management. Matt began his career as an investment analyst at Lincolnshire. He now serves on the board of the firm's Fire and Life Safety Investment Remediate and is a board observer at other portfolio companies, including Facility Services Business Powerhouse and Auto Equipment Business US Auto Supply. He's here to talk to us about the firm's investment strategy and the state of M&A in 2024. Matt, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Big fan of your podcast, and it's exciting to be a guest.
That's great. So let's start with talking about your career. Tell us about your current role and how you got to this place.
Yeah. So I started my career at Lincolnshire as an intern back in 2013, which translated into a full-time job. And then fast forward a year, I actually left the firm and did some other activities in and around finance, more so a function of youthful curiosity. And that led to some experiences that made me, I think, a more well-rounded investor. Fast forward to 2019, I rejoined Lincolnshire Management on the execution and operations team with a bias towards helping execute platforms and add-on acquisitions. Fast forward about 2 years into that, I switched over to the origination team, helping more on the front end of the deals, working with one of our managing partners in terms of sourcing and helping the execution team in the early process of deals. It's been the run so far. It's been a great place to work. The firm itself has changed a lot in the past 5 years, and I'm also excited for the future ahead.
Absolutely. Could you tell me a little bit more about your day-to-day and what your role entails? Obviously, you're on the road, but I am definitely curious to know how sourcing has changed over the past few years.
Yeah, the day-to-day is quite extensive. So the way we operate, we have an origination team, which I'm a part of, an execution team that focuses primarily on deals and portfolio monitoring, and an operations team that spends time at the company working with management to help execute a strategic vision. On the origination side, speaking for myself, a lot of my responsibilities are sourcing opportunities, either through brokers, bankers, or direct through business owners and business operators. A lot of conversations and understanding and sourcing information, but also managing the data that we collect in that process to help our deal team heads and our managing partners understand the broader macro environment and what we're seeing and some trends and behaviors that we're getting from our peer groups. The origination function is not just limited to deal flow. It's also about bringing value to the firm through third-party relationships and understanding where we can have partnerships and where we can create new relationships. I travel a lot. I think I'm probably on the road every other week, at least, if not once a week in some capacity. A lot of in-person time, a lot of conversations, and honestly trying to help represent the firm when we're out and about. I love it. It's a fun role. I think it's a great extension of what I was doing on the execution side and being able to take that execution background to present an opinion on a deal, a strategic vision with the deal team head, I think is an awesome, awesome role. And so I encourage anyone who's on the fence about origination to lean into it. So sourcing has evolved. Sourcing has changed significantly. I think it's becoming a bit more of a two-way street. The market has grown significantly. I think back 10 years ago when I started my career, I wouldn't be surprised if someone told me the number of firms have doubled. You also have the rise of independent sponsors, which created competition in the market. Strategic M&A has also been very strong. This past year has been particularly challenging, 2023. M&A volumes dropped at nearly 50%. You're at $6 trillion of M&A volume back in 2021, which was kind of the high watermark for my career, at least in terms of deal volume. And then you look at COVID, which was at 2020, which was $3.6 trillion in volume, and 2023 was $3.2 trillion. So when you compare last year's performance to a year where people weren't even doing deals for the first half of the year of COVID, it was a pretty abysmal year. So it required you to get more creative and more opportunistic on how you're creating and finding opportunities. We are particularly focused on founder-owned companies, and those companies range from 10 to 40 million in EBITDA. There's not a lot of founder-owned businesses that are unbanked or haven't been approached or don't have someone already circling. And so finding opportunities requires a lot of work now, which is why we take origination very seriously at our firm. we have ever since the beginning of Lincolnshire. We've always had a full origination team that is out there creating opportunities for us to be able to transact with, which is probably helpful to talk a little about Lincolnshire strategy. As I mentioned, we are founder focused of 10 to 40 million EBITDA. Typically, companies are in business services, just specialty manufacturing, distribution and logistics, and then consumer brands. That's still pretty broad. We don't really touch technology. We're not quick to multi-site retail and real estate or restaurants. Over the course of the firm, we've done over 110 transactions, and we're nearly 40 years old. So it's a great place to work, very entrepreneurial, relatively flat organization. We believe good ideas can come from anywhere.
Absolutely. It's really interesting, the bit you mentioned about how family and founder-owned businesses, like, they're usually not unbanked. In my mind, I always thought, okay, they're the ones who are going to be looking for banks. They're probably not going to have a lot of people circling them because they're not paying attention to them, or they're like flying under the radar. So that is a really interesting bit that I heard. Is that the case, like, especially in all the industries that you're investing in? Like, I imagine services, where a lot of deal making has been happening, that's a place where a lot of investors have been looking at family and founder-owned businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. Business services is a very attractive segment. I think the markets for which a lot of those companies play in are quite large. Most of those services are really relatively fragmented. And I think there are opportunities, especially a lot of those companies, are opportunities for improved professionalization. Aside from founders who have built companies that are incredibly large, you're seeing that private equity firms think there's opportunities to be able to slot them in with some of their existing, to service their existing portfolio, as well as look for opportunities to expand their geographic reach. I think when I look at our business services company, Powerhouse in particular, that company is using a vendor managed approach to service big box retailers, financial service systems across the country. When we met the founders of that company, it's very rare that you get to see a company get to the scale that it was at. And then when thinking about that next step in introducing M&A to their strategy, it's wise to find a partner or bring someone in who can help you execute that while being able to take some chips off the table. So we are big fans of business services within the portfolio. We have three, Crosscom, in addition to the fire and estate business that you mentioned earlier. We have a strong bias towards it, and we will continue to invest in the space even in the next fund.
Could you talk a little bit more about, like, Powerhouse, what the company services include, and when you invested in the business?
Yeah, so we invested in Powerhouse back in 2019. It was the first investment in Fund 5. Powerhouse is a facility services company which uses a network of 50,000 subcontractors to execute projects in a timely fashion. An example would be, imagine a big box retailer wants to introduce a new siding to all their stores. That could, in theory, take months, especially maybe even years, if done individually or have to manage themselves. Powerhouse would come in and effectively say, we can manage that whole process over the course of a few weekends by using our network, our proprietary technology to help manage that process and make sure it's executed with absolute excellence. Second to that, Powerhouse, with those relationships, can also provide recurring facility services. So think around landscaping, snow removal, break fix, or any like ticket-based service. These contracts can be relatively large, and they're Fortune 100 companies that we all know. That has created a very strong recurring revenue business. Drop Powerhouse is based in Growley, Texas. Aside from that, aside from being an incredible business, they're wonderful employees. Every time I go there, I feel very welcomed and like very happy to be a part of that team.
Have they done any add-ons since you invested in them, or is that something that you're gearing up to do now?
Yeah. So just talking more broadly about Fund 5, Fund 5 has had 13 investments, seven of which were add-on acquisitions. Powerhouse is no exception. Powerhouse did one add-on actually the day after it closed. So it had actually acquired two businesses the day after closing, Security Vault Works and OS2S. Both were helping execute the vision of management at the time. So think about when we were diligencing Powerhouse and sitting down with the management team and four principals at the time and saying, hey, what would you like to see? And they said, we want to get into financial services. And we were able to find a company that does ATM and ITM servicing and had that ready to go, so much so that we could close the day after. OS2S was similar business too. So we had two. Then fast forward a year, we did another acquisition called Dentco, which was more a specialty in snow removal and landscaping. And then lastly was Advanced Service Solutions, which was an East Coast-based company that was really primarily responsible for break-fix services. all of those acquisitions have been seamlessly integrated to the company using more of a endorser brand approach where Denko powered by Powerhouse, and have kind of accelerated the growth of the business to an impressive height. Aside from COVID, I think, which was it's a disrupting factor for almost nearly every company, Powerhouse has grown quite consistently.
For sure. And the other business that is also pretty interesting is Remediate, kind of falls in the business services, similar kind of recurring services category. Can you talk a little bit about that as well? What drew you to this category and then the business?
Yeah. So Remediate was acquired in 2021 when we bought a company called Barrier. This is a great case study in how origination works with our management teams. So when we had acquired Remediate, we had sat down with management and they had talked about how they wanted to expand into California. But the problems that everyone knows going into California can be challenging, especially if you're greenfielding. So once the company was under LOI, we origination team shifted our focus to finding an add-on acquisition for them in California. So after we closed within 6 months, we were able to execute on that add-on for management. Fast forward a year, we had one of their largest competitors down the street, conveniently 20 minutes away, also in Kansas City, we were able to acquire them. And then subsequently also did a much smaller acquisition in Florida, helping expand the company's geographic reach. So the way we think about M&A for our portfolio companies is that's a responsibility of our execution team and origination team. Origination team's responsibility to find and make the opportunity actionable, and the execution team's responsibility to help execute the transaction to allow bandwidth for the management team to run the business. We understand running a business is challenging. There's a lot to be done. And then to throw M&A on top of an operator's plate, I think is probably not inconsistent with the idea of being a good partner. So we tend to focus on that. Remediate is an incredible service, right? So when you go to a healthcare facility, you have to worry about the fire doors, the fire dampers, which are the vents, but the shutters between vents up in the ceiling, and fire barriers when every time you poke a hole in the wall to make sure that you can mitigate the spread of fire. It's also regular. There's a strong regulatory overview around it, largely because the mindset of hospitals defend in place. If a fire breaks out in the middle of surgery, they're not just going to quickly stitch you up and try and rush you out. So you kind of need to hope that the fire doesn't spread. Now, it's a massive safety concern. Fortunately, we don't see a lot of hospital fires, but in the event that they do occur, you have to think there's tubes of oxygen, a bunch of flammable materials, and a bunch of people who are not necessarily mobile. So there's a strong regulatory oversight, which creates strong regulatory tailwinds and a quite a recurring and recurrent business model. Fire and life safety has gotten a lot of attention in private equity in the past few years. You've seen some scale to impressive sizes, and we believe those tailwinds will continue. Really proud of the management team there and what the employees there have been able to build and continue to execute on.
Absolutely. So the focus will purely be healthcare facilities as an end customer for Remediate.
Overwhelmingly so. I'd say 90% of the revenue of the company is exclusively related to healthcare and ambulatory facilities. There's a balance of 10% that is related to construction for data centers, but that percentage of the business actually continues to, relatively speaking, is growing, but is a less significant portion of the company.
And I'm getting the sense of what the firm's value add looks like, just going by what you've told us so far about Remediate and Powerhouse. But if you could summarize and give us the bullet points of what the value add strategy is at Lincolnshire, I'd love to hear that as well.
Yeah. I think it starts with a partner mindset. So when we work with companies and owners and operators, the mindset there is we're backing management teams. So we really want them to stay on, bring their expertise. We can supplement them in terms of helping execute an M&A strategy where we're able to quickly and thoughtfully do add-on acquisitions. Secondly, we really like to work hands-on from an operating team perspective with management teams. I think these guys are senior veterans and they've held C-suite positions at multiple companies, some of which at our own portfolio companies, and they can come in and provide real, tangible, hands-on experience, roll their sleeves up, come in every day, sit beside management, help them execute a strategic vision or develop one. Those guys are also supported by our bullpen of impressive analysts and associates. So it's not just lip service, it's actually firing up the keyboard and lighting up Excel to see what actually makes sense. But at the end of the day, everyone has to have buy-in. So when we present this, it's about a collective effort. It's like what makes the most sense for the business, the people at the company, and also meeting the expectation of our LPs to provide an impressive return. Now, when I think about our value add, we have quite a long history of investing in a variety of markets. So we're pretty knowledgeable and can get up to speed relatively quickly. I'd like to second that we are a nimble organization and that we're younger. We have two managing partners now who've already started leading the firm and will begin to lead the firm in Fund 6, who have a really strong vision as how we can be even faster and how we can bring more value to our portfolio companies and our partners. So that's exciting and already taking shape. You can feel the difference. And I think our portfolio companies would say the same.
Absolutely. I do want to talk a little bit about M&A in general and your expectations are now that we're a month into 2024. Obviously, as you mentioned already, 23 was pretty rough. Do you think volumes will be better this year? What kind of factors are you keeping an eye on that would help boost M&A activity?
Yeah, so I was actually looking at our metrics earlier today. Just for the month of January in January 2024, our deal volume is up over 100%. Granted, 2023 was one of the worst years of deal volume we'd ever seen. So I don't know if that's necessarily a pat on the back or a function of the macro environment. But when I think about deal volume for this year and some of the behaviors of last year, I like to start the story back in 2019. If you were coming to market, if you were pitched in 2019 to sell your business, you came to market in 2020 and then COVID struck, you probably went on pause. Your business was disrupted, either had a bump that you wanted to know if it was sustainable that you could get paid for, or you had a dip that you thought was temporary and didn't want to get penalized for. Fast forward to 2022, you still have a little bit of uncertainty in the market, but interest rates are starting to come down. You're starting to see valuations come up. But you may be a little timid and concerned to act because you're probably still having a little bit of instability from COVID. 2023, things start to normalize, but interest rates have shot up. So if you were pitched in 2022 to sell your business, the valuation expectations that you were hoping probably aren't there. And especially if you're a business owner in your industry, you saw your peers sold at a valuation that you thought you should be getting, probably were a little frustrated that you weren't going to get that in 2023. So you withheld going to market. Then fast forward to today, it's been nearly 5 years. You're starting to think, man, I started this process when I was in my late 50s, early 60s. I'm getting up there towards retirement age. I really want to move on. And you're ready to come to market. So I think we're going to see a surge of deal flow for opportunities that were either recently sourced or have been sitting on the sideline for the past year. In addition to that, you have an election year this year. So you look back at 2020, that was a bit of an unknown entity. I think people are rushing to get their companies sold if they're for any tax policies that may impact them personally. I think this year we're more than likely going to have two known entities. I think there'll be less of a factor. And then the pending rate cuts. I think as you see rate cuts come, not only are you going to make it a more attractive M&A environment that hopefully translates to higher valuations, but you'll see a resurgence of activity from traditional lenders. Although we are in the golden age of credit, as everyone keeps saying, you're going to see more traditional banks come in and compete with those private lenders to create a really attractive M&A environment.
So would you say the first half might end up being busier than the second half, just given the election season?
Yeah, I mean, just speaking anecdotally here, when I talk to a lot of our peers and our investment banking counterparts, a lot of them have pointed towards Q2 being like probably the highest volume of deal flow for the year. Not to say that we're not going to have improvement over 2023, which isn't hard to do given the lack of volume last year, but I really hope to see a lot of opportunities that we can hopefully transact on in the first half of the year and continue our pace of deploying capital. Well, I think it's not only just good for the M&A industry, but I think it's a great thing for business owners who have worked hard to get their companies to a scale and should be rewarded for that. The one thing that I am keeping an eye out, though, is the amount of companies coming to market that are sponsored backers founder owned. I think a lot of private equity firms that invested, I think, in 2019 or 2020 vintage funds or who have been deploying capital since, starting to receive pressure from LPs to make genuine distributions, right? So you've seen valuations on paper, you've seen returns on paper, but people want to see that in a bank account. I'm proud to say we've been able to distribute capital as a 2019 vintage fund to our LPs and to help them be consistent with their vision. And that's been good for us. We're not alone in that. I think a lot of other private equity firms are going to need to to distribute capital and are probably going to take companies to market. Now, that's also coupled with the increase in secondaries and alternative structures for good assets that may need just a little more time.
I do want to circle back to the bit that you said about deal volumes going up 100% over 23. Do you mean that as the number of deals that you're evaluating at Lincolnshire or the number of deals you're getting ready to close in on? I'd love to know what that exactly means.
Sorry, I will be specific. So deal volume is up. When I checked the data just for January, the month of January, deal volume is up over 100% in terms of opportunities seen. Does that answer your question?
No, that absolutely does. I wanted to know if you're talking about the number of opportunities you're seeing have gone up or not. So absolutely. Yeah. And the other thing, you know, just about family and founder-owned businesses, I'm curious to know if there's this level of interest in family and founder-owned businesses from private equity sponsors and the number of deals that are coming to market. Is that normal or is that elevated than usual? Just because everyone keeps talking about American companies are in the middle of this great succession planning. So I'm curious to know what that's like.
Families are quite a dynamic thing. So in most cases, although the business is family owned, you're typically dealing with one to maybe two individuals. And frankly, some of these businesses have grown to a scale where though they're owned by a family or individual, they are impact the well-being of hundreds of families. So when a business owner gets to a scale and thinks to themselves, like, this business can continue to grow, needs to be professionalized, and all my wealth is tied into it, I think there's a motivation to diversify for away from the company. Or maybe their children have no desire to continue on, right? And I think when I look at family-owned companies, it kind of makes me think of that quote, it was like, every happy family is the same and every sad family is different. But in this case, I think every company and every family dynamic is a little different. And part of the mindset of being a good partner is taking time to understand that and being sensitive to that and being supportive of what the family is trying to achieve. Some people simply just need to create liquidity for themselves. Some are dealing with very sensitive and timely health concerns. And no matter what it is, you really just at the start of it need to kind of learn and understand and be respectful of that. I think as a financial buyer and a financial partner, we are very self-aware of where we think we can add value. We have definitely had instances where you meet great companies, great founders. We ultimately need to acknowledge the fact that we may not be the best partner. And that's always tough, but telling them like, hey, this is where you probably should go, or maybe it's too early to sell, or to the extent that you are looking for a buyer, it might not be us. That's the hard part of the job, is like you do see a lot of companies that ultimately, regardless of our willingness to partner, just aren't a fit. And that's hard. I mean, you've seen people dedicate decades of their lives to build something, and it never is less impressive. No matter how many companies we see, I think it's a reflection of the great promise of America and the ability to work really hard, and you can create something that's very impressive. And as much as it's the job, it's very motivating and inspiring. Just anecdotally, I feel the number of private equity firms who have a bias or a focus on founder-owned and family-owned businesses pretty high. That being said, there's a lot of opportunity, I think, at the earlier stages being the first institutional investor. But the differentiating part is how you source those opportunities and how you bring value to founders. I think sponsor-to-sponsor deals are a little more straightforward. Market's pretty well defined there. Expectations of buyer and seller are pretty clear. Those deals get done faster and also tend to be bigger. But given that now we're willing to transact around the 10 million EBITDA mark, the willingness to work with founder-owned companies is strong. More so when I look back, what are some of our best performing assets and where we've been able to do the most of companies has been at that level.
Absolutely. And obviously we've talked about 2024 being better. There's like a lot of dry powder that needs to be put to work. Has anything changed in terms of the diligence process from the peak of 21 to now? Like, are investors scrutinizing assets a lot more than they did in 2021, if that was the case back then?
Absolutely. You're seeing deals take longer, but you're also seeing deals come to market more buttoned up. Like, we have two assets in market now, and the amount of work that went in to getting those companies prepared for sale process compared to what I would say maybe 5, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, feels completely different. Especially now, processes start kicking off and moving faster, and you're kind of having to make a decision quicker, which I think has led to a lot more binary behavior from private equity firms early on saying yes or no. That's also a function of some of the companies that were most impacted by COVID have come to market, leading to some reservations around the sustainability of that performance or whether it's a market that private equity wants to play in. So when I think about us, we have narrowed our focus a lot. And I think we know what we're looking for in a company and what we want and how we get that, which is more of a private internal conversation. So we are able to make those decisions, I think, sooner. But when starting the diligence process, it's taking longer. And that could also be a function of talking that comment earlier about the lack of distributions, where some funds of a 2019, 2020 vintage are looking at performance and having to make really hard choices as to what the next or potentially last asset is going to be if they haven't made distributions. So you could see diligence processes taking longer to kind of help earn all the leaves and rocks to make sure you really understand the business. Secondly, is you're seeing, I think particularly last year was really kind of the first year post-normal year post-COVID, but really this 2024 will be the first normal year, I would say. And given that, if I was thinking about some of the companies, when you start digging into their monthly financials, you saw a lot of their growth and performance was kind of coming in the back half of the year. And as a buyer, you kind of want to see that materialize before you pull the trigger. And so you saw some processes take longer, largely just wanting to see companies hit their numbers in late Q2, Q3, maybe even Q4, depending on when you saw the opportunity.
I think all that you said so far really aligns with what I'm hearing in the market as well. People being more cautious, they want to see those performance numbers and they're less interested in looking at companies with ad backs, or they're more cautious when they're like ad backs or like, we're going to think about this a bit. So absolutely makes sense. I think the last bit that I'd ask, just looking forward for Lincolnshire, obviously you've outlined the industries that you're interested in, but I would love to know if there are any subsectors within those industries that you're focused on where you see yourself spending more time in the coming years.
Yeah, we'll continue to have a strong appetite for business services. We've done well in the space. We like some of the tailwinds around it. And we think those businesses will do well in terms of our capabilities of our operating partners. We've consistently done well in auto aftermarket and automotive related companies. Some of our best performances were around transportation logistics. And then when I look at consumer brands, we understand enthusiasts. We understand what it takes to stay relevant as an enthusiast brand. And we'll look for opportunities that fit those molds. So I know that's kind of a bit of a rehash of what I said earlier, but I need to be somewhat sensitive publicly as to what we're excited about right now.
No, that absolutely makes sense. And I think you did add the bit about auto aftermarket, which adds to what we talked about before. Anything that I missed out on asking that you think we should talk about, whether about Lincolnshire or the state of M&A this year?
Yeah, I think something that we're dealing with at Lincolnshire right now that is going quite well is a succession plan. We have two managing partners who have taken over. Lincolnshire's been around for nearly 40 years and has gone through 3 executions prior. So we understand that process. I'm interested to see how other firms start to think about that in the next 5 years and if that's going to lead to a higher rate of first-time fund activity. We think we have a strong best practices and processes in place that our new leadership will take over and be able to turn to our previous leadership, who's still very active. I see our CEO, chairman, and president are in the office every day and sit on calls and are very involved still. And I think it's great to have that there to not only help our managing partners as they take on this massive responsibility, but also be able to pass on the knowledge and experience and mentorship to all the way down to the intern level. So I'd like to see and hope that that becomes more commonplace across some of these other funds that are getting to a scale and size and kind of deploying capital and have a responsibility to support these companies with the best talent.
Absolutely. So when you talk about new funds being started, do you mean that as a function of people leaving their old firms, passing it on to a new era of leadership, and then they go out and start their own firms? Or am I misunderstanding that bit?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You're seeing a lot of that. The banking universe is huge. I feel like I find a new investment bank nearly every day. But when you talk to bankers, like the private equity universe is even bigger. So certain geographies, like especially here where I'm at today, Dallas, like the number of private equity firms I meet on a weekly basis just always makes my head spin. So I'm excited to see how that matures and how people address the session. And I think we're doing it really well.
Matt, thank you so much for a great conversation.
Well, thank you. Thank you for making time, and I appreciate this.
Yeah. I'm Nikita Satyaraju, senior reporter with The Deal. Thanks for tuning in to Behind the Buyouts.